Hello and welcome to the podcast BFI Talks, which is brought to you by Prague Finance Institute and the leading Czech Economics Research Center, CERGE EI. It is my pleasure to welcome a psychologist, an economist, and Nobel Prize laureate, Daniel Kahneman. Hello.
Glad to meet you.
Professor, because of the times and what's going on not far from Prague, where we are actually taping this this podcast from, is the war in Ukraine. But what lies actually behind it is a sort of a question that I would like to ask you as a psychologist. How do you look at this way of like perceiving what's going on in Russia from the Russian perspective? And I know that they've been exposed to a lot of what, from our vantage point of view, we see as propaganda, and it's obviously propaganda. But how do you see that actually people can still believe it given the propaganda and given that they are not completely locked out from all the other, you know, not tailored, not censored types of sources of information?
Well, I mean, you know, we know that from what is happening, say, in the United States, where people are not locked out of information. Information is available, and people choose to expose themselves to information that they are comfortable with. And so this exists when information is freely available. People prefer information that they're comfortable with. And certainly it's the case when actually there is as much censorship and propaganda and so on as the Russian public is exposed to. So it is really not at all surprising that they believe what they're told, and it's not at all surprising that most of them are not actively looking for ways of not believing what they're told. Believing what they're told in that situation is psychologically advantageous from every point of view. So this is the normal behavior. This is what you would expect.
And in your view, there seem to be indication that even some people who actually understand that they've been, and I'm talking about the Russian public, that they've been exposed to propaganda, yet at the same time, they are not really willing to accept that that something wrong has really happened, that their leadership has chosen a very destructive path.
I mean, the people's identification with their country is very strong, and that is true for all of us. And the reluctance to see our country as guilty of aggression, of a crime, is very strong for all of us. So it's really not surprising that people are reluctant to go that way. The idea my country is wrong, actually the old expression is my country right or wrong. I mean, whether it's right or wrong, it's my country, and patriotism is the most important value. So no surprises there. The psychologically interesting questions, actually, I think, are less about the public than they are about the decision makers in Russia, and what do they believe, and how do they come to, what kind of world do they live in? But this is an interesting speculation. What I think is happening to the public is really exactly what you would expect. There are so many reasons for a person living in Russia to believe in what they are told, and they are told to believe. The cost of not believing is very high. The cost of not believing means that you're a stranger and an enemy, and in addition to just being afraid, which many of them are, and with good reason. So it's shocking, but it's not surprising that you get national sentiment that seems to be divorced from the facts. And when the word war cannot be used and is actually not used, so when people are actually thinking that what is going on is an operation And then they see the response of the world, or whatever they're told about the response of the world, then the response looks completely disproportionate to what is actually being done. So that reinforces the narrative that everybody hates us, mm-hmm. which is not a new narrative in Russia, I think. So we're all in trouble. We're in very big trouble.
And then I have one specific, which is more sort of a fiscal policy question related to that, because I think we're witnessing for the first time when we decide, I mean, Russia is in a way, you know, it's a G20 economy, but this is the first time that we've actually militarized or weaponized central bank reserves on an actually monetary policy from that respect by freezing their, you know, the Russian central bank reserves. I mean, isn't it a too dangerous precedent going forward?
Well, I mean, it seems very dangerous, but not only as a precedent in terms of financial relations. It seems this is very nearly an act of war. I mean, you know, there is an intention here to destroy the other side's economy or to destabilize the economy. This is a very serious move, and it's uncertain. You know, when you're on the receiving end on this, you see it as an act of war, and then you ask yourself, what can you do? It seems very unlikely that the other side will not retaliate. Mm-hmm. I mean, they must be very actively thinking, you know, what can we do to retaliate? And this is now being done not so much to influence the other side as, you know, when it's trying to acting aggressively, mm-hmm. When it's acting aggressively in part, but it's expressing yourself, it's expressing what you feel.
Yeah.
It's only in part intentional in terms of what is the effect that you want to achieve on the other side. Mm-hmm. And we seem to have gone a fair distance that way. That is, I'm very struck listening here to some commentary. The real problem is, how do you give the other side, the Russians, a victory to allow them to get out of it?
Yeah, there's.
And without giving them some kind of a victory, this is going to escalate. And it's getting more and more difficult. They've gotten themselves into a box, and it's getting more and more difficult to find victory to give them. But it seems that if you don't, mm-hmm. They're not going to accept defeat very easily. So the question is, what will they do? And it's not obvious.
If we try to put aside the very recent, you know, developments at, you know, on capital markets, given the conflict in Ukraine, I mean, and focus on the area from the great financial crisis 2008 through the COVID response, do you think that, you know, investors have behaved rationally or have been sort of like driven by all the other influences, including, you know, quantitative easing policies, that they have sort of dulled their rationality approach to investing?
I think this is an interesting question because of the use of the word rationality. Mm-hmm. So in the common language, people confuse, I think, rational and reasonable, so that they use the two words almost interchangeably. That people behave rationally and did they behave reasonably, and people often use the word irrational for behavior that is not rational. In fact, as I use the term, rationality is a technical term. Mm-hmm. It just means logic, and it means the logic of decision making, and it is clearly impossible as a description of the way that humans make decisions, because it assumes a breadth of view and a consistency of beliefs and so on that the human mind is incapable of. But so people are not rational in the technical sense. That's obvious. And by and large, people are quite reasonable, including investors. You know, they're mostly they're reasonable. There are specific biases that are well recognized among investors, and so you have overconfidence, for example. It's fairly clear empirically that what people should do in the equity market is to buy index funds, but many people don't buy index funds. They actually think that they can do better than the market by investing in particular selected companies. Now, that is a psychologically interesting observation because there's so much data and so much information available that this is unreasonable, actually. And yet people go on doing it. Then there are many other ways in which there are many other predictable biases. By and large, those predictable biases, I think, do not have a great deal of importance in the market because there are people taking advantage of them. Mm-hmm. So the effect of, you know, you have individual traders who are highly biased, and then you have institutional traders who are less biased and who are taking advantage of the individual traders. And there's a consistent transfer of wealth, I think, from individuals to institutions, which comes from exploitation of individual mistakes by institutions that know better. And that's not in the last 10 years. You know, that's the way the market works. Mm-hmm.
So, if I understood you well, I mean, there was nothing unreasonable in terms of how most of the investors place their sort of bets during those times.
I mean, you know, you could say that the very idea that you can hope to beat the market by selecting stocks or by making, instead of doing, of going with index funds, you could say that this is marginally unreasonable, because there is a lot of evidence against it. But if you accept that, and this is behavior that is very widespread. So in some sense, saying that the whole community of traders is unreasonable, that sort of doesn't make sense to me. Behaving like most other people around you is not unreasonable by and large. You know, people just follow the norms of community, and most of the behavior in the market is really quite reasonable.
Even though we try to sometime label it as a herd mentality, but that's actually...
Well, herd mentality, I mean, I'm including herd mentality as reasonable behavior.
Okay.
It is not completely crazy to follow what other people are doing in a situation that's where you don't have better information and you see everybody running in one particular direction, your best is to run with the others, not against the others, if you don't know anything else about the situation. Now, when you are very sophisticated and you understand that they're running in that direction because of some mistakes, then you can take advantage of them. Mm-hmm. And this is actually happening all the time. So it's fairly clear that institutions are betting against individuals, mm-hmm. and winning consistently, not a lot, but consistently. So that's a pattern. So in that sense, the, you know, whatever degree of unreasonableness there is in individual trader behavior doesn't affect the market very much. It lubricates the market. You know, it gives the institutions some money to play with, but it's not enormously important, I think.
But from that vantage point of view, if I bring it back to individual investors, if there is a contrarian individual investor, you know, generally we tend to hear about successes. So you would say it's just an anomaly. If there is a, you know, we only hear about successful contrarian investors or their contrarian bets, but that's actually an anomaly?
Well, certainly, you know, from the best that we know, I mean, it's not whether whether it is possible without inside information to beat the market is still debated. And apparently, it can be done, but it can be done by a very small percentage. So when there are people, when there are professionals doing it, there is enough to cover their fees, but there isn't enough for other people, for the people who invest in them, to make money. So people who invest are probably better off just looking for the cheapest way to invest rather than, but so those people who can have a small advantage, it's very, very small, and but it probably exists. And I don't actually know where we're going.
I think I do, but maybe not really. So let me shift to sort of corporate management and biases. What are, in your view, what are the key behavioral biases of that actually plague the decision making of corporate managers?
Well, you know, what we know is that there is a great deal of optimism, of optimistic behavior, and probably at least my view of risk-taking, of economic risk-taking, is that a lot of it is driven by not understanding the odds. Now, that's not true. You know, the venture capital industry, they know the odds, and there is an industry and they're highly professional. But individual managers, one thing that we can expect them to be is to be overconfident and optimistic. And this is not very good for them necessarily, because it makes them take gambles that they wouldn't take if they knew the odds. It's very good for the economy, because that's the way you get competition and activity and innovation. But I would think this is something that we know, over-optimism. Then there are other patterns of behavior that we know about, which was, for example, sticking with losing propositions. Mm-hmm. It's sunk cost behavior. That's a pattern that is very common and extremely difficult to get rid of. That is to quit when you're supposed to be,
And cut your losses.
Yeah, cut your losses seems to be extremely difficult for people to do so.
And why do you think that particular bias is there? It's just because people don't really want to admit their failure, or they still believe?
It's not admit in the sense of what will other people think of me. It's that when you cut your losses, you are really accepting that you have lost. So long as you are hanging on there and there is a chance, then you don't have to, you don't have to think of yourself as having lost. Mm-hmm. And that is very abusive, admitting that you have lost. And it's something that people control. So by not selling my losing investment, I'm not punishing myself. And I punish myself when I sell it, mm-hmm. because it hurts. And choosing to hurt myself is something that's quite hard for people. So it's fairly natural why you have some cost behavior, and you have a lot of it. So you have optimism on one side, overconfidence, mm-hmm. and some costs on the other. Those are really quite dramatic. General biases.
Let me move on to a question which you must have heard in one way or another many times before, and it's about short-termism versus creating long-term value. I mean, is the current sort of like at least the accounting setup of capitalism at the moment, is there something inherently wrong because, you know, managers and companies are forced to follow quarterly profits and quarterly results and meet quarterly targets? And given that, I mean, maybe, you know, the recent sort of push into those sort of non-financial reporting metrics, sometimes sort of lumped under the acronym ESG, which is sort of, or sometimes just called stakeholder capitalism, maybe that's the way to redress it. So let me put the question. Is something really wrong about capitalism as we see it because of chasing quarterly corporate results? And if it is, is the non-financial reporting and meeting sort of stakeholder targets the right way to redress it?
Well, this is the time to remind you that I'm a psychologist, so I'm not. It's clear that the constant monitoring and the short term, the fact that there are short term rewards and punishment, makes it more difficult to have to maintain a long term policy. So that's a cost of capitalism, and as it is currently practiced, I think that's you don't have to be an economist to see that. What can be done to improve it? I mean, it's clear that if you remove that discipline, there are going to be costs to that too. That is, that if people do not have the discipline of, are you making money now? Are you making a profit? Are you minimizing costs right now? That if you loosen the discipline, there are going to be, there's going to be a loss of efficiency. What is the optimum and how to achieve it is completely out of my domain.
But from a, if I may try to rephrase it, from a psychologist's perspective, if you take away that quarterly discipline, would it help the people sort of like look after the longer term common good?
Well, it really depends, I think on the culture and on the incentives. And one thing that I have always found very puzzling is the idea that managers or executives are in it primarily for themselves, and that by incentivizing them to make money, you are actually making them serve the interests of the firm in those ways. This psychologically strikes me as unconvincing. I'm not sure that you really, that executives without stock options would be much less effective than executives with stock options. In that sense, the organization of the system, and this is the reason that I'm bringing this up, is that the organization of the system borrowed, I think, and was influenced by economic theory. So economic theory was telling you that you have agents who are completely selfish and motivated by profit. And then the question is, how do you take profit-oriented agents and make them serve the interest of a corporation? And you end up with options and various incentives of that kind. But if that theory is wrong, then there may be alternatives.
And do you think it is wrong?
I think it could be wrong. It depends on the culture. That is, if you have a culture where, if the culture tells people, unless you are in this for yourself, you're an idiot, then you're going to have one kind of behavior. And here, I just don't know, but my impression is that at least in the past, there was some contrast between Europe and the United States in terms of the incentives for executives. And my vague impression is that this gap is narrowing. But that's a very interesting question of whether, when you don't have that personal incentives, executives are markedly less efficient. And as a psychologist, I would doubt it.
Well, says Daniel Kahneman. Thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you. Bye-bye.